believe I've made a decision on what to do for my PC solution. We talked a little bit about this last week, how I'm having a good enough experience with the iPad that I don't want to have, like, I don't want to go all in on a MacBook Pro, even when they come out and they've got all these great ports and everything, because it would mean that I'm, like, wasting my purchase of the iPad Pro. And it's a little bit of an investment. And because of iPadOS 15, I'm having a very positive experience with it so far. So what I've decided on, I think, again, sort of the change, but I think what I'm going to do, Mayo, is buy an Intel Mac Mini, like the last version that was space gray.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and then be done.
Which is still sold, technically.
Yeah, higher end versions. Yeah, I don't want to get a higher end. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm looking at, like, on eBay, they sell them, people sell them for like $400 for, mm-hmm. you know, just a 120 gigabyte SSD, Intel Core i3, I think, you know, basic stuff, 1.3 gigahertz. So the really simple ones that are enough for what I'll be using it for, which would be when I'm home recording podcasts, because the iPad solution where I record on my iPad, but we did the call, the audio through Skype on the iPhone. You know, you get the short end of the stick on that one, where you get the lesser audio quality, and I record the better audio quality.
And we've had issues in the last few weeks where you just randomly get a phone call halfway through the show, and then the audio stops. You have to make a new file, and it's a big load of hassle.
Yeah, I do not disturb, and then only select people can get through. But when those people get through, and it's actually not an important call.
Yeah, and even if, like, you know, if your family's calling, of course you've got to answer it. But mm-hmm. on the Mac, you can just keep the recording going. Whereas on, you know, on the current iOS setup, it, like, stops the file. You have to make a new record. You know what I mean? It's just, like, so much more of an effort compared to the Mac, where, you know, I can just keep my audio running. You can just keep your audio running. And then when the, you know, when the interruption's finished with, we can just cut it out versus, you know, juggling 15,000 files.
There was an interruption once that was an autoplay ad on the web. So that was unexpected as well.
And that all just ties into, like, the iOS audio stack still feeling a little mm-hmm. immature. Like, it's fine on the phone, but for the iPad, they kind of need to, like, evolve it a bit so it can, like, properly support, you know, multiple applications having sound at once. Like, one thing I always thought would be really nice, you know, on, like, Safari, where it puts the little, like, indicator on the tab if it's making sound, and you can, like, tap it and immediately it mutes it. Like, I feel like they could do that on the iPad, but do it in, like, the multitasking UI. So, you know, when you open the switcher and it's got all the little thumbnails, if an app's playing sound, it would just have the speaker icon, and you could literally just tap it there to mute it. And so you'd essentially get, like, you know, simple multiple app audio controls without having to have, like, a massive control panel and switches and dials and, relative mixer and stuff. Just, like, a simple, like, at a glance, you can see this app and this app's currently playing sound. So if you do want to make one sharp, you can just click it to mute or whatever.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. So recording podcasts at home, I still would use this setup that I'm relying on right now for, like, the mobile recording setup, which would be fewer days than at home. So if I need to do a DFU on an iPhone or this iPad, or even I've got an iPod Classic that I need to connect to iTunes and put the, you know, flash it back again because it's got an error of some kind. Those are things that only a PC could do. So whether it's a Mac or a Windows computer. These are all really niche. The next one on my list is to get the Apple TV beta. I had to wait for the public beta version to come out, which was, you know, a couple of weeks behind the developer release, and I still was able to, like, find the story in there and finding the redesigned now playing UI for the Apple TV video and any video player that uses the new video player. But that, you know, I could have done that sooner, I suppose. And something else is, over the years, I've taken screenshots from the Apple TV using QuickTime on the Mac, and I don't believe there's a way to do that on the iPad.
Yeah, you can't do it from the iPad.
Right. Because the way, even with QuickTime, it's like kind of a workaround, but it's that you make the Apple TV your video source for the QuickTime video on your Mac. And then you screenshot the Mac window of QuickTime and then you crop around it. So it's really an edge case, but that's
yeah. The official way to take screenshots from an Apple TV is to use Xcode on a Mac. So again, not using not compatible with an iPad, but you go into Xcode, you like register your device or whatever, and then when you go into the organizer panel, there's like a button that says take screenshot, and it just saves an actual screenshot. But everybody I know just does the QuickTime method because it's so much more convenient.
Well, Xcode's a very, 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 very large app too.
Yeah, but I mean, I have Xcode installed, but whenever I do Apple TV screenshots, I do exactly the same as you. I just time it and go from there.
Yeah, I used to keep Xcode installed when I was doing my sticker packs, and then it's such a huge app to have to even just update to the next version.
Never really like thought about this, but you know, as a developer, you have to have both the shipping Xcode and the beta Xcode installed side by side. So like 60 gigabytes plus, probably 80 gigabytes of my entire drive at the moment is just, you know, both Xcode installs and all the SDKs and stuff that comes with it. Like it takes up so much room.
Yeah, that's wild. And then the last thing is just to have a local Photos library. So with iCloud Photos, to be able to have it save, not just through iCloud, but also have an offline version on a hard drive. Where this wouldn't really be a problem if I had a larger storage iPad, like say at least 1 terabyte. If I were buying, if iPadOS continues to get better and closes the last few holes that I have, then I would certainly invest in a 1 terabyte version. If I had a 2 terabyte version, I would definitely not have a concern about storage and having my whole photo and video library local. But right now, it's the easiest way for that is to have a Mac with, you know, who cares what storage inside, but an external drive attached to it, and then have that be the main photo library, the system photo library, and have it be not optimized storage, but local. So all of those things, I've looked at kind of like what's available. I can continue not having a Mac and just, you know, not having these abilities. Or, I don't know, these are not like I have to have this, but I think the main thing is that it's just nicer as an experience for podcasting. And once that gap closes on the iPad, then the rest are way smaller needs that I could just work around, or in the case of the photo library situation, you know, next time buy a larger storage iPad. But the thing with the Intel Mac Mini is interesting to me is that it's already kind of a utility use for the Mac in this use case. And so the benefits that you get from M1 on the notebooks is huge because of battery life and performance. On the Mac Mini, the M1 has fewer ports. There's no battery life to worry about. And then for these specific tasks, performance is not an issue at all. And so there could be some expanded compatibility with more ports and Intel only software. Now, that was never a use case for me when I had an M1 MacBook Air, because I'm one to not just wait for things to update, but move along and find a compatible source. So that one is mainly because the Mac Mini is space gray like my peripherals and has more ports and can be purchased for cheaper because people, you know, sell used ones. So that's around $400 that I'm looking at for used Mac Mini space gray Intel models. The only other thing I kind of considered was I have seen people sell, like for $750, the 5K 27-inch iMac, which would be a little bit older by a few years, but then you've got this massive 5K display versus what I have is a 21.5-inch 4K display, but you don't get the benefit of connecting the iPad to that bigger display, and I use the iPad with the display. So I think that kind of rules out the fact, you know, it's more money, plus it doesn't work with the iPad in the same way, so... it's one of those things where I'm not in a hurry to do this, but that seems to be what I'm leaning toward. Only thing that would make me kind of want to wait is if there were strong rumors before I made a purchase of what a redesigned Mac Mini would be like in the M1X and beyond era, because we've not yet seen what the Mac Mini can be if it were even more miniature, and that could be kind of compelling to have, you know, the newest version of a Mac Mini and then be able to, you know, write about it as well, where I'm not going to be writing about an Intel Mac Mini, really.
To be fair, we have, like Prosser had those leaks, right, which if they turn out to be accurate, the design of the Mac Mini, like, it's getting slightly aesthetic changes, but it's not a super miniature form factor or anything. It's just going to, you know, be a high performance, probably have more ports because it'll have extra Thunderbolt lanes because the M1X will, you know, be able to support that. But it's not going to be like a radical form factor change. It's like, you know, an aesthetic update. Instead of it being, you know, just aluminium, it'll probably have some, like, you know, reflective glass on the top or something. But it's going to be, you know, the same size approximately. They're not going to make it like an Intel NUC size or anything like that. It's the same Mac Mini, just with a, you know, super powerful internals to be able to wipe out the higher end version of the Space Gray Intel Mac Minis that they still sell.
I think
he's buying Intel Mac Mini's fine, like, especially for what you know, if it was your primary computer, it's obviously a terrible idea, but for the right. for the utility machine at home, it's perfectly fine. And like, even if you had an iPad that was, you know, 1 terabyte or 2 terabyte and you could store all your photos locally, like, I still get a bit nervous about the local version being A, on iOS, and B, on a portable device, because, like, when it's on iOS like that, you're limited in the ways in which you can actually get the photos out, right? So if you did have, like, a catastrophe and you know the photos are stored on your hard drive somewhere, but how are you actually going to extract those out of an iPad, right? And there are, you know, there are some ways, but it's not easy compared to a Mac where you can just go to the file instructions, drag it around. And secondly, if you do want to, like, back up to external drives, if you want to do another backup to, like, a third-party backup service, or you want to have a separate Time Machine backup as well as, like, a photo library for, like, the extra redundancy, you can only get that flexibility through, you know, Mac OS, and you're not going to get it through an iPad. And then just the fact that it's portable, it just feels less of a nice backup because it's, you know, you could drop it and break it, right? Whereas the Mac Mini is going to, like, save your house burning down. The Mac Mini is going to be fine in just in the office, you know? And it's not your only backup of the thing, but it's nice to have the backup be, like, basically almost like a smart hard drive rather than, you know, the iPad you're carrying around with you all day long. It could get lost, could get stolen, could get broken, like, all sorts of reasons. So having something at home is great for that.
Yeah. Do you, so for Windows, they have the iCloud control panel that you can install from the web, from Apple. And that puts iCloud Photo Library in what, Windows File Explorer?
Yeah, it just basically just mirrors your photo library to, like, a folder inside of, kind of like, you know, like how Dropbox works. It's like that.
Yeah. So I guess that's probably always only local. That you couldn't do optimized storage with that. I haven't ever used it, but that's just kind of my guess.
I think you can do optimized storage on it. I mean, like, I don't know how exactly it works, but I'm pretty sure you don't have to download your whole library. It might be like it only downloads, like, X at a time, and then you have to, like, tell it to download older ones or something, like, if you check the optimize option. But I'm pretty sure it doesn't require, because my dad has a Windows laptop and he uses that, and I'm pretty sure he doesn't download his entire photos to the thing. I'd have to ask him, actually.
Not having used a Windows computer in over a decade, I don't know. But I was thinking about it, and based on my you know, four needs, recording podcasts or something that can use the same input for the call as the recording.
You don't want a Windows computer. Like, come on.
I could do DFU with it. That's no problem because of iTunes.
I
wouldn't get the Apple TV screenshot thing, but that's more niche. I wouldn't be able to do the beta thing, but that's, again, it's like I could do 3 out of 4.
Yeah, but you want to try, like, Monterey or whatever the software updates are. And I think one of the nice things with Monterey is they're going to give you, you know, your Mac automatically becomes an AirPlay output, right? So if you've got your Mac Mini attached to the screen on the other input, if you really get desperate, you can just, like, broadcast to it and stuff. Like, and you have, like, actual iCloud Photo Library running. Like, even though the Windows client works, I'm not going to trust it as much as, you know, the native version, you know? An Intel Mac Mini is a much better choice than, like, a Windows computer. Okay. Like, if you could get, like, a cheap Windows computer for, like, 300, 400 quid, you know, maybe one of the NUC things, but it's just not going to integrate as well with the rest of your ecosystem. It really isn't. Versus getting, you know, the $500 Intel, like, if it was comparing, you know, $1,000 Macs versus $300 Windows options that you could get, it'd be a different equation, right? But I think the price difference is worth it, really.
Yeah. I wish I could put iCloud Photo Library on the Synology that I've got.
Yep. That'd be really nice.
There's 8 terabytes of storage just sitting next to me.
Yeah, so if you do get a Mac Mini, you could set it up to mirror that way, right? Like, obviously, you'd have to have the Echo Vertebrae on the Mac Mini, but then you could use the Synology as the network drive, which actually hosts the library if you really wanted to. Like, it doesn't
That's true.
You have it internal and you back it up to the Synology as an extra backup, you know? Like, that's the flexibility you get that you wouldn't get just having a 1 terabyte iPad carrying around with you.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, yeah, Intel Mac Mini in your future. Because my only choices for you would be either the old Mac Mini or the current Mac Mini, right? And maybe when the M1X Mac Mini is announced, like if you dilly-dally enough that the M1 Mac Mini get a bit cheaper. I don't know, like that'd be my only options to you. I don't think anything else really makes sense.
Yeah, in terms of the macOS Monterey features that you don't get on Intel that you do get on the M1, I mean, I think it's mostly the FaceTime stuff. And that I do from the iPad anyway.
And you don't get, hang on, you miss out on the 3D globe in the Maps app. Now, I don't swear about it too much, but you miss out on the 3D globe in the Maps app.
I was looking at that on the iPad yesterday, and I mean, anyone with a globe can know this, but I guess I haven't looked at a globe recently. And I always think of you as across the pond. So, you know, I'm in the US, you're in the UK. But really, you're like across the pond and like way up compared to me. Because I think the equivalent of just like going straight across would put me in Africa.
Well, I don't want to get too off topic, but map cartography, the way that a globe is not like the way that, like, if you look at a flat map of the world, it's different to like a globe, I guess. So yeah, like
yeah.
I mean, I guess on the modern like on iOS 14, it would like flatten the map out when you zoomed out, right? So it was like a 2D thing, whereas the 3D projection of the modern one, I guess, is what the actual world looks like. So yeah, across the pond is a bit of a saying, but yeah,
sure.
That's a massive tangent.
If I were in New England, it would be different. It makes sense.
All right, let's take a break. Happy Hour this week is sponsored by She's Birdie. Whether you're just walking around your neighborhood, going for a walk in the woods, running errands, or whatever, you always want to feel safe. And with Birdie, you can keep doing what you love to do with added peace of mind. Birdie is a simple and sleek personal safety alarm. It's designed to be easy to carry and simple to use. Carry it in your pocket or maybe in a bag on a keychain. And if you do get into a situation where you're worried, it just takes one quick pull to activate the Birdie. It will activate the alarm, which emits a loud 130 decibel siren and turns on a flashing strobe light to help deter an attacker. And unlike something like pepper spray, Birdie is no danger to you, which means you can feel confident to activate it without worry. Now, Zach, I know you've got one of these. Hopefully you haven't been in any dangerous situations recently, but what do you think of the Birdie?
Yeah, I received, I think, every color sample that Birdie has, and they're all very cool colors. You can fit, they're very discreet because they're so small, which is great, and they don't look like what they are. So they kind of look like just any accessory that you might have for another reason. Which I think is a good design and a good use case for this thing, is to kind of have it blend in.
Yeah, for sure. Birdie goes wherever you do. The compact alarm comes in multiple colors and a brass keychain, so it can be easily attached with your keys or a bag. Over 300,000 Birdie alarms have been sold to date with thousands of five-star reviews. Join the flock today for a safer tomorrow. Right now, She's Birdie is offering you 15% off your first purchase when you go to shesbirdie.com/happy hour. Go to She's Birdie, that's spelled shesbirdie.com/happy hour for 15% off your first purchase. Once again, that's shesbirdie.com/happy hour. Thanks to She's Birdie for sponsoring the show.
All right, so you recently did a test with watchOS 8 beta on the Apple Watch, and this one I admittedly flew under the radar for me, but it's a voice feedback during workouts on the Apple Watch. What does that do? What did you learn about it?
Yeah, like this, I just randomly came across this when I was clicking on some settings. And I was like, is this new? I from the description, I wasn't sure if it was like an accessibility feature or if it was, you know, added recently, but I like looked it up and yeah, it's actually new in WatchOS 8. They did mention it in like one paragraph of the press release on day one, but as far as I know, no one else had really covered it, so I thought I'd try it out. And basically, it gives you voice announcements generated by the Siri voice on the watch whilst you're doing a workout in the workout app. So let's say you're outside running, you've got your AirPods in, you just, you know, going for a half an hour workout, half an hour run. Well, when you finish the first mile, the Apple Watch will say in your ear, you know, mile one complete, you're at pace 10 minutes an hour or whatever, 10 minutes a mile. And then when you go the mile two, it will say the same thing. When you reach the halfway point, so, you know, 15 minutes into your 15-minute work, into your 30-minute workout, the Apple Watch will say, halfway, keep going, you know. And then when you get to the 30-minute mark, it will say, goal completed, 30-minute workout done. And you can choose to keep going or you can stop there. And so basically, when you're doing a workout, every time that the watch would normally, you know, buzz your wrist, tap you on the wrist, and you'd look and it'd give you one of those little like alerts about a status update about the workout. Well, now you can get those rather than having to look at the watch face, which is, you know, if you're especially doing like a running workout or something, it's hard to like stop and look and tilt your head and stuff. Instead, the Apple Watch just speaks it to you in your ear, which is actually a really nice feature. And it also works for like if your activity rings are getting closed. So while you're running, if you actually complete your exercise ring, say exercise ring completed, and then just carry on. If you're playing music, the Siri voice just ducks the sound volume down. It says its announcement and then it goes away and the music carries on. And this works whether you've got AirPods in or like, you know, Bluetooth headphones paired and attached, or if you don't, the Apple Watch's speaker will actually just say it directly. So you don't, even if you were just like running with no headphones in, the Apple Watch's speaker will emanate out the Siri voice instead, as long as you haven't got your watch set to mute, which when I first tested it out, I didn't realize that it would work just out the speaker. And because most things on the watch, they tend to require headphones, right? So I was like, okay, it works with headphones. I did take my headphones out and it didn't play it. So I was like, okay, it doesn't work. But that's only because I had the mute setting turned on. So I normally go around my life just with a watch always on mute anyway. And I just let it rely on, you know, the taps to have a look and stuff. But if you want to take advantage of this feature, it probably makes sense to leave your watch unmuted, because if you or at least if you're not, you know, doing a workout with headphones attached to the watch.
So part of that reminds me of just every other workout app, including like your running club, that would have voice feedback during workouts. So and watchOS 8, they finally brought it to the Apple Watch, a native app for workout. But I definitely benefited from having the voiceover in Nike Run Club in years past, you know, give you a progress update. Not just that, but also, you know, audio coaching sometimes, and celebrity voices if you were doing like a special run of some kind. So I like that as a feature. I'm glad it's there now. I hadn't thought about it in years, but now that it's there, that's good. Especially the ability to have it without having headphones in, because I know a lot of people do run without having any kind of headphones in for safety or for focus, and having it come through your watch is just that much easier than more informational than having to look at the screen and be distracted. So that's very neat. I did go on a run last week. It was my first run in a while, and it hurt, but it was good. And I had my phone with me. And I was on my bike. I didn't want to leave it on my motorcycle. So I had my phone in my hand and the watch on. I had AirPods and listening to music. And I was also in a group chat with iMessage, with messages. And I had the feature to announce messages on. And my music was playing, which was wonderful. It's how I have to run, really. But then I was also getting, every time somebody would in the group chat would talk to each other, I would hear what's going on. And, you know, as soon as the run was over, I turned it off, so it never happens again. But in that experience, it was kind of, I mean, I would never choose to do that again. But if you like that, it's kind of useful, because I mean, it was Siri reading what everyone was saying to each other. And then I could reply with voice if I wanted to. And it doesn't have to just be messages now. It can be, I think, any kind of alert in iOS 15. So it was, again, nothing I would do again. But to hear that play with the music under it, because the music will duck out whenever Siri is speaking, it wasn't terrible. Like, it wasn't as bad as, you know, if you just can't play music anymore. Because your music kept playing and you could hear what people were saying over it wherever they did message. It's kind of neat. It kind of felt like I was not missing out on that chat while I was going for a run. But again, I would never do that again, because part of the run is to get away from everything.
Yeah, and they did actually make it a bit better in iOS 15, the announced messages feature, because now before it was basically just like, do you want to hear, you could always choose like which apps are allowed to, you know, do the messaging. And now obviously now it's a notification, so it's like every app can do it technically, and you have to like turn them on or off or whatever. But for messages specifically now, they let you choose, do you want Siri to announce all notifications from messages or only those that are time sensitive and direct messages to you? So if you want a bit of like filtering out the noise of just all your group chats, you can actually do it. So it's only if you're having like one-on-one conversations with people, or like your people in your VIPs or whatever you've set up in your focus can actually, you know, interrupt your workout and make the noise in your head. So they've added some, you know, nice little bit of extra granularity there for people that want it.
Yeah, cool. All right, next up, the Apple battery pack, the MagSafe battery pack for iPhone 12 family phones. It's now in stores and in customer hands, including a number of us at 95 Mac, not either of us, actually. But we've seen what people have to say about them, and we know a little bit more about how they work, what they're good at, what they're not so good at. What have you seen so far, Mayo?
Yeah, so the watt hours is 11.2, right? That's how much the MagSafe pack has. And an iPhone 12 is 11.7 watt hours. So you'd think, like, naively that the pack would be able to, like, fully charge an iPhone 12, right? But Jeff from 95 Mac, he's been testing. He actually got two iPhones and two battery packs, I believe, just to, like, confirm his findings. And he found that the MagSafe battery pack can only charge his phone from 0 to 40%. So that seems either something's a bit wrong somewhere or that's just, like, bad. Like, because, you know, if it's only going to 40% on iPhone 12, what percentage are you going to get to on a Pro Max, right? It's going to be even less than that, because all the battery packs are the same capacity regardless of what phone you use them on, right? Because it's, you know, MagSafe pack rather than like a case that fits the phone size. So with that issue put aside, I otherwise think that the MagSafe battery pack has been received pretty much as I expected it would to. I'd say there's like no other surprises. Like, it charges at 5 watt, which is quite slow, but the thing with the, like, it's the same with all the smart battery cases before it. Like, you just kind of, Apple just wants you to kind of like just put it in the case and not worry. And then, you know, you charge your phone as normal, and then you end up with 4 or 5, 6 or 7 extra hours of battery at the end of the day, right? Because you've got this extra lump fitted on the back of the unit. Mm-hmm. And the overall thickness of the thing seems to be about the same as the old cases. Like, it's thick, but so are the cases. I guess you can argue slightly of the aesthetics of the cases are slightly better because they were like molded into the shape of the phone, whereas this is like a brick that, you know, magnetically snaps on the back. But I think it's fine. Like, and I know you can get third party magnetic battery pack things that have more capacity and stuff, but if I was in the market, I'd probably get the Apple one anyway, even though it's always gonna be more expensive because Apple loves to overcharge for their accessories. But, you know, the convenience of it being all in one is pretty nice. And you do get, like, the reverse wireless charging. If you're charging your phone, it can charge the pack at the same time, which is cool. I think this would be a big obstacle for you, of course, is that if you are putting the MagSafe battery pack on, or it's almost like a permanent addition, you can't wirelessly charge anymore, right? Like, you have to charge with a wire. Whereas the smart battery cases, they still supported Qi charging out the back.
Yeah, they didn't at first, and then the last versions of them did. Mm-hmm. So, I think the last version of the battery case for the iPhone was the most practical because you did get wireless charging. You know, you put the case on a wireless charging pad. This is pretty MagSafe even, and the battery pack charges your iPhone charges. You can live without having the port, basically, if that's how your lifestyle is. And mine usually is, unless it's wired CarPlay. They even had the shutter button. So if you were taking pictures, which is thing, you know, if you're using extra battery, if you're using a lot of photo and video taking, then you might use extra battery. So it's a really practical use case for that. Obviously, with no case aspect to it, it's just the battery mount, then there's no shutter button aspect to it, unless you're just relying on the standard volume button while you're using the camera. But this button would open the camera app and then have a function. I think that's the biggest thing for me, that not having purchased one yet. I haven't rolled it out, though. It's just one of those things, again, like I said last week, that I just buy on a whim in a store and not purchase for pre-order and then not actually need for a while. I didn't consider that last week, that you can't put the phone on the battery and the battery on a MagSafe pad and then just charge the two things that way. because that's more how I'd use it. There's kind of a MagSafe accessory lane that is things that attach on the MagSafe magnet part, and instead of having wireless charging. So the wallet is that way. This is that way. If you use, if you leave out of the Apple, world, then there's even like a pop socket accessory that is like this. And to me, MagSafe is better wireless charging, not a way to attach things to the phone. And so if the wallet is kind of okay because you don't have to charge the wallet. So you just take it off, when you're at home and pick it up when you leave. That's okay for me, but I don't use it every day. But if I ever have a case where I'm ever have a use case where I want to have limited things on me and just have my debit card and my driver's license, and then I'll do that. Because it's kind of a 2 to 3 card max thing, but you can't even have that on permanently if you wirelessly charge, because it's not going to charge through the wallet magnet. And so that's the way that the battery case is, except the battery case needs to charge it as well. And so I'm not quite sure. Is it that you can't even charge the MagSafe battery pack with MagSafe on its own on the soft side? It has to be a wire, even correct, if it's off your phone.
Yeah.
That's like when we were talking about this as a concept, end of last year when the iPhones were new, then that's not how I would have envisioned it. And that's a pretty big kind of point of friction for me in making it. In addition to all the other things, like, I'll take that it costs a lot because it's Apple and it's not as, doesn't have as much utility because it's sleeker. But that part where it takes away your wireless charging basically, and you've got to always charge it with a wire, that's a pretty big downside. And it only comes in white, so like if they had colors that would be better. If it was $80 instead of 100, which maybe they'll go and sell at other retailers, that's okay. But the fact that you can't wirelessly charge the battery case or your phone when you're using the battery case is a pretty big one for me. And then the people that work with us, so Chance and Bradley and Jeff and Poda, like, Those are four people who were excited about this. Parker even did a really good mock-up several months ago of like, mm-hmm, what this could look like if it existed. And of course, in his mind, he never expected it to be a wired-only charging accessory. but even with that, I think he has a theory that it might be iOS 15 is causing issues, that it's like a line of code missing where it's just not optimized yet and it's just really inefficient.
Yeah, because to me, like, just like a naive smell test, only charging to 40% sounds like too much like inefficiency, that Apple wouldn't even ship it if it was only going to go to 40%, because we know the actual battery capacity is 11. So I would expect to see closer to like 70% charge on an iPhone 12, maybe 70 to 80.
Yeah, only other thing I'll say about that is Parker did do a hands-on, so you can see what it looks like in pictures with the iPhone, and then Jeff Benjamin is doing an extensive review that'll have a YouTube aspect to it as well. And I think that'll be a pretty good comparison of how does this compare to other magnetically attached batteries that charge wirelessly. So I would have thought that the clear winner would be something that's actually MagSafe from Apple, but it seems to be that the sort of batteries that come out that's, they're not MagSafe per se, but they are wirelessly charging batteries that attach magnetically, that those are perhaps better.
Yeah, and I mean the big win that you get with the third party ones is they do actually have like a connector, a plug or a socket, or you can connect other things to them. Like, you don't only have to charge through the magnetic charger on the back, right? They have little like USB plugs on them as well as being magnetic chargers, so you can charge any device that way. And the MagSafe battery can Qi charge like AirPods and other accessories and stuff, but if you just want to like plug in with a wire, it can't help you there. It can only charge that way. So it's a mixed bag. That is kind of what you'd expect Apple to do, right?
Sure. I would say that with feedback, maybe the next version could be better, but this came out so late in the iPhone 12 cycle that it will probably be the iPhone
14
the iPhone 13 replacement that has a new version 6 months or 9 months into this cycle. And maybe then they don't care about the smaller phone size and they make this for the 12 sized phone and the max sized phone.
And they have two versions. It'd be very odd if in November, they were just like, here's the iPhone 13 MagSafe charger. Like, I think this this pack thing, they probably wanted to keep unchanged for, you know, several versions, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
Happy Hour is also brought to you by BetterHelp. It's a stressful time. Life is hard normally, but the pandemic certainly hasn't helped matter. I know people get more anxious as all these variants keep popping up all over the place and stuff keeps getting shut down again. And, you know, the vaccines are great, but it's just not a great time. And if you feel strained or just not as happy as you used to, sometimes you just want to talk to someone who's trained about mental health and lifestyle. And BetterHelp is quite literally here to help. It lets you do just that from the comfort of your own home. BetterHelp assesses your needs to match you with a licensed professional therapist tailored to helping your personal well-being. You can simply connect in a safe and crucially private online environment. After signing up, start communicating to a therapist in under 24 hours. This is not run-of-the-mill self-help. It's professional counseling done securely online. You can access counselors specialized in all sorts of areas like stress, anger, relationships, depression, sleep, and much more. Start a conversation with your therapist at your convenience. You just send them a message at any time. The therapist responds in a timely basis, and you can schedule sessions like weekly video chats or phone calls if you want something more personal and face-to-face. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid options are available. And of course, everything that you talk about is 100% private and confidential. Start living a happier life today. As a listener to this show, you can get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/MacHappyHour. That's MacHappyHour. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/MacHappyHour. Thanks to BetterHelp for sponsoring the show.
All right, Mayo, there's this new thing that's been all over the news this week, Pegasus and the idea of a zero-click vulnerability with iPhone security. Sounds kind of scary. What is Pegasus and what should people know about it?
Yeah, so Pegasus isn't like new, right? Like, this thing's been around for a long time, and we've covered Pegasus before. What this report really was showing like the extent and the breadth to which it has actually been deployed by nefarious actors, right? And so this came through an explosive report from Amnesty International, and they collected device logs from thousands of people, processed them, and found evidence of the Pegasus malware running on these phones. And then they did a big write-up. They got like security research to look at it, and they did some analysis, and they basically did a big write-up about how this software is being used and how it's being, you know, sadly abused, and also just how resilient the Pegasus malware is to, you know, Apple's continuing attempts to resist it, right? So basically, this Israeli firm called NSO Group, they're a bit renowned. They sell this malware for iPhone and Android that essentially allows exploited devices to secretly transmit messages back and forth, transmit all your photos around, as well as record your phone calls and sneak you record for the microphone, all this stuff. And it's widely known that, like, NSO Group claim that they only sell the spyware software to, like, you know, government agencies or investigating terrorism and stuff, but it's basically been known for a long time that NSO Group sell this Pegasus thing to pretty much anyone that gives them the money for it. And so, you know, especially in all these third world countries in the Middle East, all these countries that have more dictatorial and authoritarian regimes, they've been buying this software and using it on their own people to crack down on them, to enforce, you know, their right of rule or whatever, and spy on their subjects essentially without like due cause or any real reason. Amnesty highlighted that it found evidence that Pegasus has been used to target journalists, human rights activists, politicians, like all these people, right? So it's bad. It's a bad situation. And that was kind of like what everyone always kind of knew was going on, but we never had like evidence to prove it almost, right? And I think in some isolated cases, like and I'm sadly blanking on the name, but is it Khashoggi, like the person that got assassinated? Yeah, so his phone was infected with Pegasus malware back in the day. So part of the way that they tracked him down and they were spying on him was through this malware. And so clearly, you know, it's not just being used for legit counterterrorism, right? It's a big thing. It's used by whoever they want, basically, who has enough money to pay for it. And we kind of knew this was going on, right? Like, it's not a secret, but this kind of just doubles down on the prevalence of it, how often it's being used and how it's being used. And if you are like an individual person, you probably don't have to worry, right? Like, if you're just a standard person, especially someone in the West, you know, in a democratic country like America or Britain and stuff, the government's not going to be using this software to spy on you, right? You'd have to be pretty, be pretty high on your conspiracy theories to believe that kind of thing, right? Like, if you're just a normal person going about your business, you don't have anything to worry about. But if you're, like, a member of government, you know, a political activist in countries like Israel and China and places like that, then this spyware becomes of, you know, higher relevance to you because it very easily could be deployed. And the software is installed in many different ways, but the most scary way is that Pegasus is often installed on a zero-click basis. And that basically means that someone can send you an iMessage, right, from this random iCloud account that you've never heard of before, and the carefully crafted payload of the iMessage is essentially a hack of the phone that it interprets wrongly. It basically installs this malware, and it essentially is installed without you having to do anything at all. Normally, like other times in history, you've had to like click on a link and it takes you to a website in Safari, and then there's an exploit in Safari that installs the malware. But right now, and at least since 2019, it seems that Pegasus has basically been installed in a zero-click fashion. So an iMessage is sent out, the phone interprets the incoming payload, and it goes, well, it handles it however it does in the way that's wrong, and hence it gives them full access to the phone. And part of the report details the changing nature of Pegasus, because obviously Apple doesn't sit still. They're always releasing software update with security fixes and bug fixes, right? But basically, this report has a very detailed roadmap of, like, in 2019, it exploited a bug in the Apple Photo service, maybe via iCloud Photo Stream, and then Apple fixed that, and then Amnesty found in 2019, and then moved on to an iMessage exploit. In 2020, it moved into an Apple Music exploit, an exploit in the Apple Music app. And fast forward to the present day, they found evidence that of iOS 14.3, iOS 14.4, iOS 14.6, there was still evidence of that Pegasus being delivered using a zero-click iMessage exploit, which is pretty bad, right? And obviously Apple's, you know, it's hard to criticize Apple as long as they're continuing to fix the stuff, right? Like, every single month they're always releasing new fixes when stuff happens and they find it out. They release patches and this stuff gets fixed. And then the NSA group finds a different way to exploit the same thing. But at least for me, like, as long as they're responding in a timely fashion to attacks, I don't mind as much. If they were doing nothing at all, then that's bad, right? Like, similarly, the repeated calls for, like, an option to have end-to-end encrypted iCloud backups, right? Apple, so far, has done nothing on that basis, and it doesn't seem like they're working on it. And there was actually a report that Apple stopped doing it because of government pressure or whatever else. So that is something I feel like you could definitely criticize them more for, that they don't even give you an option to have end-to-end iCloud backups. But on this, they're always releasing security updates. It's not like they're letting it get through. It's just these hackers and these malicious groups are incredibly skillful at what they do, and they get paid millions and millions of dollars in the process. One other thing to point out, though, is that with iOS 14, Apple was trying to crack down on this zero-click exploit through iMessage because they launched this framework which is called Blastdoor. And basically, all these it was a new internal private framework that Apple built out inside of iOS that would supposedly make it harder for these kind of exploits to happen, because it would be with, like, all the message parsing would go through this, like, sandbox process, and it was written in Swift and all this other stuff, and it was brand new. But clearly that didn't make much of a difference, because, you know, the Amnesty report finds plenty of evidence that zero-click exploits were happening against all versions of iOS 14, including at least up to iOS 14.6. It's unclear if it affects iOS 14.7 or iOS 15, but even if Apple fixes the exploit, the report basically shows that, you know, it's likely that the NSO group has another load of exploits just waiting in the wings, ready to switch out to install Pegasus in another incredibly alarming way. So I guess on one level you can say, well, as an individual, you don't need to worry, but also if you even did want to worry, there's basically nothing you can do. So that's that's the state.
I think the way I would think about it is anyone who could be exploited could be exploited using this method, regardless of where you're from. That if there's someone who could use your personal information against you in any way, then it could even be in a Western country without it being some crazy conspiracy, because there's certainly a climate for concern as long as you're exploitable, you know. So that's what I put that. But it's just like we've learned more about how widespread it is, not that it's a brand new thing, but that it's active in the wild. Apple can't have an answer for it, and if you're concerned about it, then the answer is like you have to use an offline device, basically, unless you want to be, you know, at risk of this.
Yeah, because obviously the focus is on iOS in this report, but the same thing is everything I just said would basically apply to Android as well. It's not like Android's like a safe haven. Both platforms are attacked by state actors, by national groups, by these crazy people on a weekly basis, and there's just piles and piles of zero-day exploits that these companies exploit. So it's not like Apple's Apple's underperforming here. They're unfortunately at the status quo, which means not very good, if you know what I mean.
sure. All right, let's move into the Apple Car segment this week. So there's a new report on a prominent member of Apple's technology team who is involved in the Apple Car now. And I think my main takeaway before we get into the details is that Apple Car project lives on still. I have friends who say like...
Your friend's working on it?
I have friends who were on the team years ago, and there's been so much turnover. Now, I have friends who like still don't believe that Apple will ever make a car, because it's just, why would the phone company do that? But it's also like, why would the computer company make a phone? Yep. And the bigger thing here is that Apple, you know, if the future of driving involves autonomy, then they are a tech company, and they're heavily invested in what you can do with LiDAR and machine learning. And so that part of it makes sense that it's not just that they would make a normal car, but that they could have an application that makes, you know, their technology a big part of what drives cars in the future, literally. So what's new this week in Apple Car?
Yeah, so basically the car project continues. You know, for a while it started basically up in 2015. They were going to make a car then, but then Apple kind of backed down a bit and just focused on making the autonomous driving technology. And then it seems like about the end of 2019, the idea that Apple's now going to actually apply, you know, their research and development to actually making a physical car seems to have gotten steam again inside the company, because they've been hiring all these people. They hired that Porsche chassis guy. They hired Doug Field back from Tesla, who basically, you know, worked on the actual car and stuff. And so it seems like they are, again, focused on making an actual car. Still, we're still talking years off, you know, shipping, right? But they do seem to actually be working on it again. A report from Business Insider this week said that Kevin Lynch has actually been tapped to join the team working on the car project. Obviously, Kevin Lynch came originally from Adobe, where he worked on all sorts of things, but then he was brought to Apple in 2013 to lead the Apple Watch project. He has the title of like VP of Technologies or something. But basically, the hardware for the Apple Watch was, you know, it wasn't finished, but it was like designed. Johnny Ive and his team had worked it out, right? So when Lynch joined in 2013, his job was basically to lead the operating system, and everything that you see on watchOS was done under his purview, essentially, right? Obviously with input from all sorts of different people. One person doesn't make a company, blah, blah, blah. But that was his oversight. And he's also worked on like the health app and Apple's health initiatives. And you see that reflected in WWDC, right? Because what does he present? He presents health stuff and watch stuff, right? But now it seems like they are giving him oversight over the Apple Car as well. So probably if you look for parallels between the watch project and the car project, you know, Lynch isn't doing the autonomous driving stuff. That's the car is still being run. The car software on the autonomous driving side is still being headed up by John Giandrea, right? But in terms of like the user experience, what it actually looks like when you're inside the car, how does the software work? Probably like integration with all the, you know, so with Siri and all this other stuff, that's now coming under the head of Kevin Lynch. And what I take away from this is that if they're getting like what I would, you know, to a first approximation describe as the consumer facing guy involved on the software side, that probably means they're heading towards actually making the thing. You know what I mean? Like while it's in the development stages, yeah, it can just be under like the machine learning research group, and then they do some like hardware prototypes or, you know, internal sketches and stuff. But if you're getting Kevin Lynch to be like, right, now it's time for you to actually like make the car operating system, then that means they're on, to use the pun, the roadmap towards the final product, right? So yeah.
Yeah. So bring on glances like the Apple Watch had, and the friend button to see your friend circle faces.
Yeah. Look. Yeah,
no, that's an interesting point. And then and this isn't even just as new as the Business Insider report, right? It's that it seems to be further this year.
Yeah, like I think Mark Gurman said he came in like March or something. So.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So. Just to put on top of that reporting, and so that's interesting. I hadn't analyzed the news in that way. That if it's him, if it's Lynch, then to pull him off of another project, that's more mature than it was. But also has, you know, it's not finished yet. Like the watch software, then that's interesting. So yeah.
Cool. Yeah, and I don't think you can compare like. You know, Lynch joined the Apple Watch in 2013 and it shipped in 2015. I don't think you can just like copy and paste that over here. But, you know, if you're looking at like the 3 to 5 year schedule, basically, is probably what you're looking at for the Apple Car to actually come out at this point. You know, vaguely. Cool. Just based on all the reporting that's been so far, based on the talks Apple's having with production partners, and it seems like they might work with Foxconn and a US factory, et cetera, et cetera. And just as a quick response to your friend's opinions about, you know, like, why is Apple even bothering with the car? I think a very easy answer to that is, you know, Apple controls your life and all your experiences through your phone, right? Right? That's your day through your iPhone. But where can you not use your iPhone? In the car. You know? So if they want to control your entire life, they have to control the car experience. And CarPlay is only taking them so far. And clearly all these companies see a future where if self-driving vehicles can be cracked and you can have autonomous cars that don't require a human to always be at the steering wheel, you're going to unlock literal hours of additional time where people are doing stuff, or, you know, or no longer having to be tied up actually driving. They want to be doing stuff, you know, productivity, entertainment, all those things fall under Apple's remit. And just like the amount of power that Apple wields over like the App Store, because they have a dominant phone platform, right, with iOS, I think they want to have the same control in the car, ideally. And so they're going to try and compete on that level. And I think an Apple car would be pretty cool. Maybe it'd be too expensive, you know, but I'm sure Apple could do some really cool designs and integrate some really cool technologies in to get it all working pretty neatly, right? Like, I think Tesla's done a pretty good job, you know, so far. But there's no reason Apple couldn't do something similar / better, in my opinion, right? Like, they, you know, obviously Tesla's clearly in the lead at this point. But if Tesla could do it as like an upstart small company, you know, Apple's incredible resources plus all the integration with their incredible ecosystem of stuff, right? I feel like they could put up a pretty good show when they eventually, you know, finish this thing.
I think that the biggest piece of evidence for me to argue for them making a car is that Tesla just moved their full self-driving feature from a $10,000 upfront purchase when you buy the car to a $200 a month subscription option. And that is so Apple to do.
The services revenue. It's just bing, 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 bing. The other thing is, by the way, if you want to talk about services and cars, if you can crack self-driving, then like Uber, Lyft, all those services, they become like completely irrelevant because you could just have your own self-driving car fleet that transports people around. And like taxi services can just be a branch of you selling a car, right? You could sell a car for personal use, or you could sell a car that just, you know, that's part of a fleet that just runs around the city and picks people up and drops them off. And that's easy, you know, that services revenue all year round, baby. Like Tesla said they want to do that eventually. Elon Musk was like, we're gonna have 1 million self-driving taxi on the road by 2020, and obviously, you know, his dates are a bit optimistic, but in the future, like 5-10 years, and Apple's going to be around in 5-10 years, that is clearly something that they're going to at least want to try to have influence over. And finally this week, Happy Hour is brought to you by Smile Software. Supercharge you and your team with the power of Text Expander. Text Expander lets you do more with the same resources. Less repetition, fewer errors, and greater consistency. You can turn the things you type into reusable snippets that can be used again and again and again. Improve your productivity by taking advantage of Text Expander. It removes the repetition out of your work so you can focus on what matters most. And now there's improved web app security to help keep your content protected. Save time and be consistent while you're at it. Speed through email, just type a short abbreviation that expands into a reusable form with fill-in-the-blank fields to customize the reply as appropriate for the current message. And TextExpander makes it easy to give your team the right words for every situation. You can be sure that they get it right every single time. Whether you need to keep legal happy or just want to delight customers with effective answers, you can rest easy in the knowledge that your team has got it covered. With TextExpander, you keep your team accurate and current with all the changes and latest messaging for your business and brand. You can share snippets like signatures, email signatures, messaging, descriptions with everybody who's working on a project with you. And of course, TextExpander is just as useful as an individual. You can use TextExpander's powerful shortcuts and abbreviations to streamline and speed up everything that you type on your computer. You create a powerful snippet just once, and then use the assigned abbreviation to let TextExpander fill out the rest for you with fill-in fields and customizable forms. No more repetitive typing and no chance of a human error. TextExpander works everywhere that you can type, like Slack, Google Docs, email, web browsers, a lot. And you can get TextExpander on Mac, Windows, Chrome, iPhone, and of course the iPad. Take back your time and unlock your productivity with TextExpander. Listeners to this show can get 20% off their first year subscription. To get that offer, visit TextExpander.com/podcast to learn more and sign up. That's TextExpander.com/podcast. Thanks to TextExpander and Smile Software for sponsoring the show.
Okay, Apple Pay. There's this report that Apple Pay could get this new feature that's kind of in between Apple Pay Cash and Apple Card. And the idea is Apple Pay later. So tell me what that is, Mio.
Yeah, so if you were talking about things that sound right down Apple's services alley, what's better than getting people wrapped on debt and reaping interest payments? I mean, this on the scale of Apple's, like, Like, ethical receiving of money, I think credit cards and all that kind of stuff rank pretty low on the list. But it's certainly true that this kind of area of, like, buy now, pay later in the like, digital economy is exploding. Like, you've seen companies like Affirm and PayPal offer this stuff. And Bloomberg says that Apple's going to rival those companies by integrating a Apple Pay Later feature directly into the Apple Pay sheet. So when you buy something online and it comes up with the Apple Pay button, inside of that screen, you'll be able to say, like, buy it on financing and get 0% interest for, you know, X period. Or similarly, when you're at, like, a retail location, you could do, like, contactless payments with Apple Pay, and whatever you tap to buy, you could buy that on financing. So today, with the Apple Card, you have the Apple Card monthly installments thing, where you can buy, like, iPhones and iPads and basically anything from the Apple Store. You can buy it on 0% financing over 24 months.
Any price. Like, they show monthly payments for everything, even if it's $10.
Yeah, yeah, you can buy a MagSafe battery pack on monthly installments. You could buy the Lightning to 3.5mm adapter if you really wanted to on monthly installments. Mm-hmm. But obviously, that's currently restricted to Apple's products. But the Apple Pay Later scheme would be basically anything in the world that you buy with Apple Pay, and it wouldn't require you to have an Apple Card either. So it'd work with your existing, whatever bank card you currently use to buy stuff with. You could do it with Apple Pay Later instead. It will require, like, approval, and you have to have, like, a credit check, etc., etc. But once you've, like, been approved, it will just appear in the Apple Pay sheet. Bloomberg has some details on exactly what the offers would be. It's kind of like a combination of interest-free and interest-accumulating plans. So it basically says, when a user makes a purchase via Apple Pay on a device, they'll have the option to pay it either across 4 interest-free payments made every 2 weeks or across several months, but the several months payments comes with interest. So if you only wanted to buy it, like, you'd get 4 payments every 2 weeks. So 2 times 4 is 8. So basically over 2 months, you could get 0% interest. Or if you didn't want, if you just wanted to buy later with, and it doesn't say what the interest rates could be, but I guess they could be as high as like 20-30% or something, then you could get Apple Pay monthly installments that would last a longer period of time. Like, I think this feature's fine to offer, but, you know, it doesn't really, like, excite me or anything. Like, the Apple Card has more, I think, relevance in terms of, like, you know, Apple actually offering a contribution to the market and not just trying to, like, scrape some percentages of money off the bottom of every transaction you make, you know? Like, whereas this feels you know, more in that arena. Like, I don't feel like the convenience is that, like, the amount that Apple can actually bring to the table is quite small. At least with the credit card, there was a lot of stuff they could do, you know, and even more stuff they can still do. Whereas this feels quite like surface level and just a way to like skim a bit more money off the top. I don't know what you think.
So is the thing that it makes this interesting to Apple is that the threshold for, I guess, eligibility is much lower because it's based on a purchase-by-purchase basis instead of a here's a large amount of credit that you apply for, and that they're just kind of lowering the entry for who they can finance and that kind of thing? Because I was wondering, like, why even bother if you're Apple?
I mean, I guess so, because I think getting people to sign up to a credit card is a lot higher of a barrier. Like, even if you're eligible and you can get approved for the Apple card, like, people don't want to change their credit cards, right? Like, or they, you know, some people do, but I think if you look at the entire population, it's a lot easier to convince someone to say, like, just click a button during the Apple Pay checkout process, be like, you know, would you actually want to pay £1,000 for this thing right now? You could spread it over £250 payments over 7 months or whatever. Like, versus, why don't you sign up for this credit card, right? Like, there's a lot more aversion, I think, natural aversion from a consumer to be like, get an Apple card versus buying something on financing, right? And the fact that it's built into the Apple Pay sheet, it just makes it really easy to do it, which is kind of bad if you, you know, if you actually want to be a responsible person when it comes to credit financing.
Or if you want to be not a target, if you want to avoid being a target in antitrust.
Yeah. Yeah, like, Apple is already under investigation from the EU Commission for privileging, for promoting Apple Pay over other contactless systems on the iPhone, because frankly, other contactless systems on the iPhone can barely exist, right? Like, you Apple Pay, you tap to Apple Pay, Apple doesn't really let anyone else do it, like, integrated to the system. So, you know, the EU's already investigating them for privileging Apple Pay too much over rivals. I'm sure they're not going to be too happy about this news either.
All right, and finally, Apple TV Plus. So there's some news here in terms of what could be coming, acquisition talks, and awards. So what's going on there?
Yeah, like, the acquisition stuff, I think Apple's, like, having talks with everyone, probably just like every other big company does. And I think what's happening is, after the MGM acquisition happened, like, Amazon bought MGM, right? I think all these media companies are just like, well, we can bump up our own perceived value by just saying that everyone's going to acquire us. Because in the last, like, 2 weeks, Apple's been having talks with the NFL about getting Sunday Ticket games. They've been talking about acquiring, supposedly, Reese Witherspoon's Hello Sunshine media company. And they've been talking about acquiring A24, the independent, like, movie studio. I mean, I'm sure Apple's maybe having talks with these people. I don't think, like, none of these reports actually say, like, Apple's looking to actually make a bid. They're just all like, Apple's mulling, Apple's considering, Apple's talking to them. You know, $1 billion here, $3 billion here, Apple could afford that, right? Like, it's only a week of iPhone 7. The problem you have to come with any acquisition, Apple can pretty much afford anything. Like, you know, unless you're getting to the hundreds of billions of dollars, any number that's below, like, $20 billion, Apple could buy and they could pay it back in, like, a quarter of, you know, income, right? But you see,
just do Apple Pay later.
Yeah, but you see, look at the company history. They're very averse to doing acquisitions at any scale, right? Like, the biggest one still to date is the Beats acquisition, and that was like 2014 for $3 billion, right? And we've seen much bigger acquisitions from much smaller companies, like Facebook bought WhatsApp for $16 billion, for instance, and even the thing we were just talking about, Amazon buying MGM, that was $8 billion, right? So if Apple's going to make an acquisition here, they are going to be careful about it, right? Like, and I think the Hollywood industry has this kind of, like, perceived notion that Apple's in, like, desperation and they, like, have to buy someone or they're going to be, like, way behind. And, you know, obviously they're not the front runner in TV at the moment, right? And maybe they never will be. But to execute what they want to do, I don't think they have to buy a studio. Like, maybe they do and it's beneficial, but they don't have to do it, right? I don't think there's, like, an urgent rush. I think they're maybe more likely to come to, like, sports streaming deals, like the Sunday Ticket thing, is a, you know, possibility that Apple could probably sell as, like, an add-on to TV Plus. Like, you have to buy TV Plus $4.99, and then maybe you buy, like, the sports package, which is an extra, like, $10 a month or whatever. So you're paying $15 and you get Apple Originals, and then you get live sports as well from the NFL or whoever else they make deals with ultimately. But just because there's a rumor going around that Apple's like been talking about the NFL package, it doesn't mean they're going to... A, it doesn't mean they're going to make a bid, and B, it doesn't mean they're going to win a bid, because Apple's not the only one talking to the NFL about buying Sunday Ticket games, right? Like, this thing is going to be like multi-billion dollars per year in licensing fees, and there's a huge interest from Amazon, from Apple, from all of these players, right? Like, Warner Media, maybe, with HBO Max might want it. So people have to slow down a little bit. The bidding timeline for the NFL Sunday Ticket package hasn't even started yet. Like, I think it's like starting at the end of the year, so you know, it's not like tomorrow Apple's gonna be like, well, we bought the Sunday Ticket games, you know, have at it. This is a very slow process. It takes time, and it would be irresponsible for Apple not to like explore opportunities and maybe find deals, right? I don't think they like in a rush to buy something that they don't perceive as good value. If they came across something that was like, oh, we can get a decent catalog here, we can get some clever people for, you know, not too much money, then maybe they'll, you know, try and get it, like the A24 acquisition possibly, for instance. But it's not like a, oh, Apple's 100% buying them next week, we're just waiting for it to happen. You know, like, I think people are getting a bit too, like, up in the, the word's not coming to, but you know what I mean, like, the frenzy of it rather than, like, the reality.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, my take on the three different ones, so if you look at the NFL Sunday Ticket, I think the reason that Apple's involved in that story at all is because they are a player in it, but they're, I think even the source report is, like, they're not a top player in this. They're just the headline because they're the most recognizable or like attention grabbing of all this. It would be the most news making versus like the norm continuing. With Hello Sunshine, I don't know. I mean, it's they work with Reese Witherspoon, so that seems possible. With A24, that's interesting. I think the Hello Sunshine one seems like more like, let's try this out and as like a, what is it like if we buy one of these companies? With A24, it might be like, what would it be like if another company bought one of these companies that we work with a lot and have a, you know, good relationship mm-hmm. with? So would that stop our current relationship from happening in the future? Obviously, the ideal for Apple is just to make deals for certain creators over certain periods of time and not have like this be in-house forever. But that's what I think is like the Sunday Ticket thing, just because it's Apple, it's the headline, but it's not, it's a very low chance that Apple is going, that Apple would end up victorious in that bid. And then the other two,
like, they'd have to really want it to get Sunday Ticket, you know, they'd be committing like $10 billion or something, which they can do, but they can do a lot of things and they choose not to, right? Like, yeah. And you look at Hello Sunshine, like, oh, it sounds great. Oh, you just buy Hello Sunshine, but they already work with Hello Sunshine like 20 different ways. What is the advantage of, you know, making the deals for all the shows that they make, like The Morning Show and, you know, five other shows they got in development or whatever, versus buying them? Like, are they really gaining much by buying them out? Like, I don't see it personally. But like, whereas if you look at something like MGM, at least you could say, well, you're getting the MGM people, plus you're getting the 17,000 catalog and stuff you can throw that in too. You know what I mean? Like, and then with A24, you could at least say, well, you know, Apple's doing all right on the TV side, but their movie sides are lacking, right? And they need more movies. And A24 is a really good, renowned movie studio. So so I'd be like, if you asked me to choose which one sounds more sensible, I'd definitely pick A24 over Hello Sunshine. But, you know, if it's cheap enough, then I guess they'd pick it up and just, you know, amalgamate in and just count it as like a shortcut to growing the Apple TV Plus division rather than having to go and hire everyone individually. But we'll see. Mm-hmm. And then Emmys. Basically, this is the second time Apple's had a presence at the Emmys. Last year, they got 18 nominations. This year, they got 35 nominations, including 20 for Ted Lasso. Ted Lasso's a huge hit, both by audiences and by critics. 20 is the record for, like, new freshman comedy at the Emmys. I think the last one was, like, 19, set by Glee, like, 10 years ago. So everyone loves Ted Lasso, audiences and critics alike. And the other thing I'd only point out here is that they went from 18 to 35 nominations, which is obviously like a doubling, which is good for them. You know, awards help Apple attract talent to the service because basically people come to the streaming service for three different things. Either, you know, money, and Apple's got money. Audience, Apple hasn't quite got the audience right. Like, they're obviously the smaller service at the moment. And then prestige and critical acclaim. And if you can have shows in your service that get lots of awards, you're more likely to attract talent, right? So having something like Ted Lasso, where, you know, it basically like swept all the categories and nominations across the board, they have like 7 supporting actor nominations. It's kind of ridiculous. That's good for, you know, Apple's outlook. And obviously they like to promote Apple TV Plus as being the premier service where they get, you know, shows that are award winning, etc., etc. So that's good and whatever. The Emmys, you know, you can, different people have different interpretations of how like legit an award service is at the in Hollywood. Like, are they kind of rigged? Are they kind of not? Like, who knows? But if you just look at the wider picture, Apple like doubled their count from 18 to 35 this year. So, you know, they're obviously doing something right. And last year, Apple relied heavily on The Morning Show to get nominations. For this Emmy season, The Morning Show wasn't eligible at all because the second season hasn't come out yet. And because of the pandemic, it got delayed. So, you know, Apple's like big awards drama series wasn't even eligible to get nominations. So if it was, then maybe they'd have even more nominations than 35. So pretty good turnout. But at the end of the day, like, Emmys are, you know, Emmys are like whatever to, you know, the consumer, I think, and nominations are even more whatever.
Yeah, the most important thing is that Ted Lasso season 2 comes out on this Friday.
Yeah, so as this episode is released.
Yeah, and also I tried Smigadoon, mm-hmm. On its 2-episode release last week, and when you know that story from a while ago where it's Apple TV will be the NBC of streaming, where it's all family friendly and it's all kind of, you know, in this certain tone. I mentioned to you that I thought that Smigadoon was like the most NBC thing yet, although it had some sort of sexual innuendos that made it a little bit edgy, but that's also like safe for NBC. It doesn't hurt that it's got NBC talent from the creator to, you know, one of the stars. So that's a thing. But you told me that to say is NBC like doesn't mean much to you in the UK because you don't see NBC.
Yeah, exactly. But I can kind of guess roughly what you're going for, but yeah, like, I agree. Yeah, I watched it too. I thought it was fine, and, you know, it wasn't, like, groundbreaking or anything. It was, you know, just enjoyable TV. But it's good to have, like, variation, right? Because you don't want every single series to have, like, you know, be filled to the brim of profanity or be filled with a thing of, like, explicit nudity and stuff. And so as long as you've got variety, it's good. And, you know, clearly all of Apple's series aren't, like, limited to the NBC level, which would be bad. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we also saw this week a trailer for the Jon Stewart show, which was the most un-NBC thing in the world. So, clearly then, like, whoever came up with Smigadoon, they just wanted to do something that was more, you know, wide. And obviously it's parodying, like, 50s musicals, so it's in that style, and so it fits for that show.
I liked it enough to learn the name of it, so that's what I'll say. I'll watch it every week. I think it has an interesting story to it, and the Jon Stewart thing. Do you think that trailer is anything like what we'll see in the show?
I assume it has to be. Like, why would they spend that much money on? Because they had like CGI and like, you know, name actors like George Costanza and like recognizable people and stuff. Like, I feel like the actual show is going to include like sketches like that as well as like an in studio segment. Otherwise, I always expect that clip will like form part of the first show or something, right? Because I don't think, you know, Apple has a lot of money to throw around, but why would they finance like that 3-minute teaser if it had no relevance to the actual program at all? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was well received on Twitter. It caught me out of left field. But
I mean, obviously, like, you know, the space side is like, well, it's mockery, and like, I guess Stewart kind of was probably quite derogatory about it, but I enjoyed it as like the comedy part. Even if for like, sure. You know, obviously I want space exploration to succeed, but even I thought like these, you know, recent things that Bezos and Branson did, they were more like PR stunts than anything, because they, you know, it wasn't like exploring the moon, right? It was like going 50 right. miles up in the air and coming back down again 5 minutes later, which is not much different than going on like those little like, you know, adventures where you go weightless for like 2 minutes in that, you know, that plane. So
yeah.
I think at both levels it kind of worked for me, but. But it was definitely what I'd call on the nose, and like, you know, he certainly wasn't Jon Stewart like not pulling punches. Like, he was pretty explicit in many different ways.
Indeed. Yep. All right, that is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. If you have any feedback for the show, you can email us together at happyhour@9to5mac.com. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at ApolloZac. That's ApolloZac. And Mayo, you're on Twitter at
BZAMayo.
And thanks to everyone who subscribes to the ad-free version in Apple Podcasts. We really appreciate those subscribers. If you haven't yet, try it out. You can do a free trial. After that, it's what, $5 a month, Mayo?
Correct. Or you can subscribe for a year for $50 a year.
Good deal. Or maybe if you wait, you can Apple Pay later for it. I don't know. We'll but that's the podcast this week. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in.
Bye-bye.